After speaking on adultery, Jesus transitions into the topic of divorce. And if you were present in this Old Testament time, there were a few ways of seeing divorce. There was two schools of thought that would kind of point to you which direction you should believe when it came to this topic. One would be the school of Shammai, the other would be the school of Hillel. And the school of Shammai taught that divorce was permissible only in the case of very grave circumstances, an example, adultery. The school of Hillel permitted that a man would divorce his wife in the case of any small infraction on the part of the woman. For example, not wearing your hair down, not having the right makeup, burning your food. And so if you wanted to divorce your wife, you would have a certificate of divorce written up for her. And it was just a simple one-sentence statement that would tell her, hey, there's some differences between us, and in fact, I won't have anything to do with you. And so you are free to leave, and you are free to remarry. And normally what would happen if you had a character, if you had some type of backbone, what you would do is you would walk your ex-wife to the family that she belonged to, and you would also present the dowry. You would give them a refund. And so here Jesus is saying, look, you've heard it said before, but I say to you, this is how it once was, but now this is what I'm kind of presenting to you. I'm giving you a better option. I'm raising the bar for you. He says, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except for sexual immorality, you have caused her to commit adultery. And whoever marries this woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now, this is a bit tough. Can you agree? Because is this a separate thought that Jesus is kind of curtailing verse 33? Or is this one whole thought that goes in to the whole context of the teaching? I do believe from who I know Jesus to be that this is one whole thought. And that the woman that Jesus is talking about in the last part of 33 is indeed the woman who divorced for another reason besides adultery. And so Jesus, what he's saying here, if you're going to divorce your wife for any other reason than adultery, you are at fault for her committing adultery in her future marriage. That means it's not legitimized. There isn't a reason for you to commit adultery to begin with, and so don't do it. Because God the Father is not going to look at that divorce and be okay with it. In fact, it's not his plan. When he put together the model of marriage, divorce was not like a part or a thing that was added to that model, if you will. When he looked at marriage, he saw two human beings that were made for each other, created in his image to reflect his glory. And so to look at divorce as part of that model is to be unbiblical. But if you're like me, you've known that divorce can really damage somebody, can mess with us. It can cause us to have the tendencies or to see divorce as an option. When you're sitting there and you're talking about marriage with somebody and you know you're just so in love and you're excited about it, you never really think about divorce, but in the back of your head, you're like, but what if it doesn't work out? And you begin to listen to yourself and your comforts. And the things that make you feel comfortable, that maybe if it doesn't work out, there's still another option. That's something that we wrestle with as humans. It's not a small thing that 50% of people still end in divorce. They read the same vows. They have a celebration. And one out of two end in divorce. And so in looking at this text, because I know who God is, I can comfortably say that this is one whole thought. Because I know my God as a redeeming God, a reclaiming God, a God of second chances. And so I can look at this thought and say, no, God, I know that there are men who abused women, who caused them to flee, who caused them to be adulterous, who didn't love them correctly, who didn't love them biblically, and they went and found somebody else to be loved by. And so because I know God to be a redeeming God, a loving God, a forgiving God, we can look at this as a whole thought and say, God, you have a plan for these. You're not done with these two human beings. I know that about you, Lord. But we must still deal with this text. What Jesus is ultimately doing is this. He's exposing the root of divorce. Divorce, from its inception, has been rooted in the heart. It's because of the hardness of your heart that Moses allowed the people to commit or to go through with a divorce. There's no other reason behind it. Not because she burnt your meal. Not because she didn't look good one day. Not because she doesn't make enough money. It's because of the hardness of the heart. So what Jesus is saying, look, it's not anything to do with any reason to get divorced. It has to do with our heart, with the depths of our soul, where the root begins to take place. Men were abusing it. They were taking advantage of the system that God had put in place. And honestly, it needed to be dealt with. And who better to deal with it than Jesus? He says, no more divorcing women for no reason at all. No more bailing on the covenant that you had between yourselves and the Lord. No more breaking the vows that you once pledged to one another. See, God knew that marriage would be difficult. He knew that we needed an eternal source to be a part of our marriage. When he saw me and Carol walking separately in two different lives, he was always desiring to be the center of our individual lives before he brought us together. And the only way that we can continue being fruitful as a couple is if we continue to place Jesus in the center of our marriage. If he continues to be centralized throughout our difficulties. And if you're looking at someone and you're kind of like googly-eyed and you love them and you want, you're maybe thinking about marriage, I ask you first, is Jesus the center of their lives? Is Jesus centralized in their individual thoughts, in their individual behaviors? Because if he is centralized, if he is there in the middle, in the heart, that's where the treasures will flow from. That's where you're going to find the person that was created for you. It's when you look at their heart and you're like, Jesus is there on their throne. The very core of their being is filled and surrounded by, permeated by the presence of Jesus. He knew that he needed to be the center of our lives. And through Jesus, we see that he held up to his end of the deal. The cross made a way for us to be able to have Jesus at the center of our lives. When the veil was torn, when access was given, when we now, as we can enter boldly into the throne room of grace, it is like we're accepting the invitation of Jesus into our lives. He says, draw near to me that I may draw near to you. Let me reciprocate that love for you. Though this was his best option, today our lives are crowded with the quickest solutions to our problems. When things get tough in our marriages, when our circumstances draw our blood, we don't look for ways to reconcile, we look for the easy way out. What is the quickest way that I could please her in this moment? Oh, is it do laundry? Okay, cool, let me just do it. Is it cook dinner? Okay, let me just do it. Is it change my baby's diaper? Okay, let me just do it. And we look to the easiest way out of this situation. We look for the easiest solution, all while never changing the core of who we are. See, the practice is there, but internally we're still the same person. We're just doing everything that they've asked us to do. And we'll go on having the same argument over and over and over. And I'll be completely honest with you. I hate having those arguments. I hate having the same argument with my wife over and over and over again. You know why I hate it? Because it proves to me that I haven't changed. And until I change, until I allow Jesus to be centralized in that place, my wife is not going to trust me the way I want her to trust me. She's not going to love me the way she was meant to love me, because there's something missing. There's something that hasn't been dealt with. And so when I look at my wife, I need to, if I want to love her correctly, I need to serve her biblically. If I want to meet the standard and exceed her expectations and prove to her that I am the man that God created for her, I need to deal with the sin that's in my heart. I need to deal with the things that have messed me up in order for me to have the clean hands, in order for me to love her and serve her diligently. And so what Jesus is presenting here is something radically different than what we men bring to the table. See, we like to come home and kick our feet up, take the remote and turn it from Disney Junior to ESPN. We like to bark orders. Where's my food? Can you put my shoes away? But not so with Jesus. See, Jesus comes in and he changes our behaviors to where we come into a situation where my wife has been serving my kids and teaching my little ones. It's three girls, 7, 5, and 2. It's not easy. And for me to come to the house and start barking orders and demanding things is no different than what she's already been through for the rest of her day. And so if I'm going to be Jesus and I'm going to come and serve her, I need to change my perspective before coming into the door and say, how can I alleviate this? How can I carry your load a little bit? How can I make things easier for you in this moment? And I'm not considering my comfort. I'm not considering what makes me feel good. Me feeling good is kicking my shoes up, grabbing a cold one. LaCroix, of course, you know, I don't like to drink beer. And barking orders and telling people what to do because you just came from a job where you're being told what to do, right? So now it's your turn, and you take this position of entitlement, Think about if Jesus came down and he was just like, boop, there's a throne there, and he just sat in and he began to bark orders to the people that he wanted them to follow him. That's not what he did. He's like, come, let me make you fishers of men. Let me show you how to do this. It's the difference between me coming home after a full day's work and saying, you know what? I'm gonna kick my feet up. Or, hey, baby girls, let's go get the laundry baskets and let's make mama feel good. Let's do this right now. You ready? On three, go. And they would go, they get the laundry baskets, they bring them up, they start dumping them out. Let's start sorting. Okay, Lulu's jammies over here, Abby's jammies over there. Here's the Krav Maga stuff, here's the ballet stuff. And then, okay, let's fold them up. Boom, 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 all ready. Mommy's in the kitchen cooking food, and we're over here taking care of business. She comes home, she's like, hey, what happened to the laundry? There's like three baskets. And the girls are just so excited to tell her, look, Mom, we took care of it. Daddy helped us. He discipled us on the way. You should see my wife's face. That doesn't feel comfortable for me though. But I know it makes her feel better. And it confirms who I am and what God's done in my life and makes her want to trust me and want to love me. See, we're not reactive. Like I'm not waiting for her to bark orders at me in order for me to do something. I'm being proactive and saying, look, let me help you a little bit, honey. Let me love you a little bit. Let me serve you a little. I know I don't feel good right now, but I'm gonna lay down my life. I'm gonna carry your cross and mine. She's right over there. That's what modeling Christ looks like. But see, normally, it's hard. It's hard to do this, especially when we're wounded and when somebody's wronged us. We must realize that Jesus in this text is asking us to do the hard things. Number one, to see divorce as a last resort. Divorce shouldn't be the first thing we think about when things go wrong. Reconciliation should be the first thing we think about. How am I going to forgive my wife for thinking that way about me? How am I going to make this right? How am I going to repent? How am I going to show her that I still love her? How are we going to make this better? Like, I don't want to keep having the same argument over and over and over again. How can we fix this forever? Centralize Jesus. Stop divorce before it becomes a thought. Which brings me to point number two. To see the need for Jesus in our marriages. We need to know every hard verse of the Bible isn't there to scare you. It's there to point you to the necessity of Jesus. And this verse is hard because there are many of us who've been plagued by the cause of divorce. Many of our parents have been divorced, have thought about divorce. The hardest conversation I had with my dad is trying to get him to reconcile with my mom. This happened when I was 19 or 20 years old. And thank God they're still married to this day. But it was the hardest thing I had to do. There's no evidence for adultery. There was nothing wrong. It was just indifference. So the hard thing to do is what God is calling us to do. When we come to the hard points of our lives, it's meant to point us to the necessity of Jesus. It's not meant to steer us away. It's not meant to cause us to be fearful. It's not meant to like bring our self-esteem down. It's meant to point to the necessity of God in our lives. And after explaining this to this very Jewish audience, Jesus goes on to point number two. Again, you have heard it said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. That's the old way. But I'm telling you right now, just stop swearing. Jesus again is calling this new community to do something that is hard. You know, being a pastor, you get called to a lot of meetings with people, right? And when they start the text with Pastor Hector, that it's all downhill from there. It's gonna hit the fan. It's bad news for sure. Because then if they call you Hector, or I get the H, you know, like if they start the text with that, it's pretty good. It's good news. But when they start with Pastor Hector, comma, and they start a new paragraph, it's on. And so I get a lot of text messages. Hey, will you go to coffee with me? Hey, will you go to lunch with me? Hey, will you hang out with me? I need to talk to you about some stuff. I know it's going to be some heavy things that are going to be said. And as we go through that motion and start meeting with people, sometimes it's just hey, I just want to see how you're doing. But most of the time, it involves work. And you know what happens? Like, let's say I'm meeting with somebody tomorrow at like 7 a.m. I'm an early riser. A lot of you know that. Tonight, I would get a text. Hey, are we still on for tomorrow? Like, you might think, oh yeah, that's normal. No, that's not normal. If I told you that I was going to meet with you tomorrow at 7, that's my commitment already that I'm going to go and meet with you at the place that I told you. Now, if an emergency comes up or that place doesn't open up at 7, I could see changing the time or the place. But why often do I see that text as an invitation to bail? This is your chance, Hector. You don't really want to have this conversation. You got stuff to make you feel good. You can have your coffee by yourself like an introverted, extroverted pastor that you are. I don't know, I'm somewhere in between. Like, I like being alone, but then I like being with people. It's kind of weird. But like, I'm just like, what do I do? Should I bail on this person? Like, when that's an invitation, like, hey, are we still on for tomorrow? I don't know what it is. My flesh wants to bail on them. I get an hour more of sleep. Get to hang out with my kids more. And I don't allow my yes to be yes and my no to be no. We're like the maybe generation. Has anybody ever asked you, like, hey, you know, like there's this serving opportunity right away. You're going through the Rolodex of how many ways you can bail out of it, right? You're just like, oh, let's see. I think I'm busy. You know what? I'll pray about it. That's like almost guaranteed a no. You know, like when you say I'll pray about it, you're just like, yeah, I'm not going to that. For sure not going to that. That's just how I am. Is that me? Just me? No, right? But if I tell you, and you'll know, yeah, I'll just be completely honest with you. I won't tell you I pray. I'll tell you straight up to your face, no, because I'm heartless. But if I tell you I'll talk to my wife about it, then that's almost a yes. It's like a 9, that's like a good, like, solid 90. But if I start thinking about it, and I'm just like, I don't know, like maybe, that's a no for sure. Why? Because like, this is it right here. Jesus is dealing with my unfaithfulness right here. He's saying, look, man, just let your yes be yes or your no be no. It's that simple. Why is it so hard to say yes or no? It's because we're afraid of commitment. Because if we commit to something, that means we have to be responsible, right? And we've been trained by this culture to not really be okay with commitment. To not really be responsible about our stuff. And we look for the way out all the time. We fail at letting our yes be yes and our no be no. Not by just bailing on our commitments, but by never committing to anything at all. That's where we fail. It's not by saying yes and then changing our mind. It's by being indifferent and saying, I'll get back to you. Let's remember that Jesus is promoting a higher standard, a standard that takes us from meeting the minimum expectations to exceeding those things. And in the Old Testament, there was a sense of keeping things fair. It was indeed an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And we would love that. We would love for it to be fair in this day and age. We would love for the drunk driver that got away from hitting my friend to get caught. We would love for people to, we would love for that to come back on them. People in the Old Testament got what they deserved, and it was formulaic. In obedience, there was blessing, and in disobedience, there was cursing. And Jesus, in this text, takes it to the next level. He says, if someone wrongs you, he says, don't resist them. Don't repay evil for evil. Why? Because this is not how the Lord has dealt with us. This isn't how we've been dealt with the Lord. Like when we first came to Jesus, we had a mile-long debt that he cleared for us without us ever doing anything. When Jesus dealt with our sin, he dealt with it once and for all, the Bible says. It was while we were yet sinners that Christ would go to the cross for us. And it is while we were at war with him that he was nailed to the cross. And while we were dead in our trespasses, he made us alive in him. And so that's how he absorbed the hit. How do we absorb the hit? When somebody wrongs us, when someone talks smack on us, when our peers challenge us, when they bear false witness against us, when they smack us on the cheek, how do we respond? Actually, how are we supposed to respond? Jesus says, turn the other cheek. This new community doesn't just meet a good thing, it exceeds that thing. And he says, if you want to be a part of this community, guess what? You're going to be wrong. In this world, you will have trouble, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. That's what Jesus said. And so when we're wronged, when we're taken advantage of, when someone sins against us, our first response must not be, how do I retaliate? But how do I forgive? And how do I absorb the next hit? When I turn my cheek, how do I stand up to adversity? How do I change the perspective of somebody sinning against me? The next part of the text, he says, someone asks you to accompany them on their journey. He says, double their expectation. During this time in Jerusalem, the Roman soldiers would be covering the streets. And if you were just hanging out, rolling dice with the boys, they could come up to you and say, hey, my man, I need you to do something for me. Can you carry my load? And you would have to do it and carry it for at least 1 mile. Now, you might have seen this text and you're like, oh, they just want me to walk with this dude for 2 miles instead of one. No, what he's saying is, look, if people who are oppressing you, who I know you don't like, right? There's always beef between the Romans and the Jews. He's like, I know you don't like them. I know there's drama between you. They've been oppressing you. You've been under their thumb. If they ever ask you to go 1 mile and carry their burden with them, you know what I want from you as a new community of Jesus followers? I want you to go 2 miles. I want you to double their expectation. When they want just you to kind of like ease their lives a little bit by 1 mile, you know, it probably takes you a good 15, 20 minutes to run, walk a mile, whatever. Go with them a half hour. Show them that you love them. Why? Because one day, the cross that was meant for you, I'm going to carry. One day, the debt that you were required to pay for your sins, I'm going to pay for. And I'm not just going to do it from that point on. I'm going to do it forever. Jesus here is telling the Jewish community to love the way he was going to love, to bear burdens the way he was going to bear burdens, to care for and to love and to come alongside of people the way he would come alongside us. He's like preparing this picture for us of what the cross would look like. And then he says to him who asks of you, give to them. If anyone wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. This is very, very, like it causes participation. Like Jesus is saying for us to change the entire nature of our culture. To change the way we see giving. To change the way we see carrying each other's burdens. To change the way we see loving our wives. To change the way we see when people wrong us and do us dirty. Jesus is saying, look, I have a better option for you. Yeah, you could retaliate. Yeah, you could get divorced. Yeah, you could, you know, be greedy. But I want you to give. I want you to love, and I want you to be generous. Our lives should be marked by generosity. Like people should look at our lives and say, man, either that person has a lot of money or they're extremely generous with what God has entrusted them with. And that's the person I want to be. And I have trouble with that, man. When somebody gets wronged, like I want to just give. Hey, you've been wronged. Like this last weekend, one of my friends, he was wronged. You know, he's paid for something and the guy like he was wronged. And immediately I'm like, hey, bro, what's your Venmo? I want to make this right. And I sent him money because I felt like I needed to be generous. And guess what? The guy who he was wronged by made it right. And he's like, hey, can I give you the money back? I said, no, dude, look, I gave that to you. You go be fruitful with it. And he's going on a missions trip to the Philippines. And I'm like, you go be fruitful to it. I knew that I was called to be generous at that moment. And God was going to use it for his glory. And he was so blessed. And so we need to have the marks of generosity. Not only in the way that we give, but the way that we love, the way that we carry other people's burdens, the way we forgive people, the way we seek reconciliation. See, it would be greedy for me when somebody wronged me to not present the gospel of grace. It would be greedy of me when I see somebody in need of Jesus and I say, you know what? Never mind. I'm not going to share with you the gospel. It would be greedy of me to withhold something good from somebody that's in need. And so with my students, if I know that they need something, I'm going to be generous enough to give them to them, even if I get in trouble for it. I will take the hit. I will get the slap on the hand. If God's called me to be generous, I'm willing to take the hit for the sake of the gospel. But if we're not willing to take the hit when it comes to our marriages, when it comes to when somebody wrongs us, then are we really representing Christ in the way that he took the hit for us while we were at war with him? See, if we want to be Jesus' people, we got to bear the marks of Jesus.